This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 p.m. This is the last Booktown I will be doing. I began the program 10 years ago this month, and that seems to me enough time for anyone to be doing something like this. When I realized or decided that I was going to give up the program at this time, I started planning a couple of years ago what I was going to do in my last few months, and particularly what I was going to do on the last program. And it occurred to me that the very first program, when I was just feeling my way, had turned out very interestingly. I had been at the Nevada County Library looking up some computer books and had seen a title, The Age of Spiritual Machines by Ray Kurzweil. The title was fascinating. I took it out, I read it, and found the content fascinating as well. He's an inventor, a futurist, a big proponent of the idea of a singularity, that technical progress is increasing so fast and that the rate of increase is picking up so fast that we will soon reach an almost vertical asymptote, and that the world at that point will be totally unlike anything we've ever experienced, that there will be a melding of human and artificial intelligence, there'll be a melding of humanity and robots, there'll be many scientific and technical transformations that we're just beginning to think about now, but will suddenly become commonplace and will follow one another at an ever faster pace. He claimed in this book that anyone who was alive in 2020 would be able to live forever if they want to. In the 10 years since then, Ray Kurzweil has continued to propound these ideas. One of his more recent books is The Singularity is Near, in which he goes into much greater detail. And he holds seminars. He has a Singularity University and quite a few ways of propounding his ideas. I actually subscribe to what's called the Kurzweil AI newsletter, which means that every morning in my email, I receive about 10 news stories, 10 science stories. And I'd say about three times a week, I find one that I want to pursue. Some of them are fascinating, some of them are chilling, some of them are both. When I read this, that anyone who lived till 2020 could live forever, it struck an odd nerve in me, because I had decided at about that time that 2020, when I would be 75, was probably about as long as I needed to be here. And I was thinking of possibly checking out at that time. I thought it was strange that if I decided not to, he thought I could live forever. Since then, I've gone back and forth on that idea, and I'll be discussing it a little later, farther in the program. Nonetheless, for all the personal resonances that his ideas triggered in me, they seemed very, very one-sided. It seemed entirely technical-oriented, entirely mental, entirely intellectual, scientific, technical, whatever you want to say, and without any real concern for where it is that we're actually living and who else is living on this planet and how the planet itself functions. And at about the same time, I had been rereading some essays of Gary Snyder's. I can't remember exactly which one. As I go back, I think it may have been the one called The Etiquette of Freedom from the Practice of the Wild. And in that program, I read a little bit from that book and talked about the totally different worldviews of the two people, Ray Kurzweil and Gary Snyder. So when I decided about 2 years ago that I would be ending the program today, I thought it would be great if I could get those two people to come on in the same program, and I could actually see how they would interact with each other. I tried to contact Kurzweil 3 or 4 times through various channels and never got a response. That was last November, December, this January, and so on. It was a lot easier getting in touch with Gary Snyder because he lives here, and I run into him usually about once a month. So in the end, I asked him if he would come on, and as it turned out, when I mentioned Kurzweil's ideas, he said he didn't know if they would do well on the same program because their worldviews were so different. I'm going to find out right now if that's the case or not. Gary is in the studio with me, and we're going to be talking for the next 45 minutes or so about his view of the world, maybe his view of the future, and whatever he would like to talk about. Welcome to Booktown, Gary.
Thank you. Nice to be here today.
From what I said just now, do you think you would find Ray Kurzweil a difficult person to converse with?
Well, you know, somebody with a set of ideas like that, presuming he believes in them himself, you wouldn't want to have your first meeting, I don't think, on the air. You might want to be able to have lunch first and actually find out just how much and at what point a person is committed to whatever it is they are saying. Because my first question to him would be, do you really believe that stuff? Or is this a way to sell books? Which is a fair question.
It could also be a way of selling supplements. He and a doctor have gotten together with a rejuvenation program, and you can buy mineral and vitamin supplements through him, which supposedly will keep you in good shape till the time is ripe for you to live forever. But I think he does believe in the ideas, and there are many people who question them very severely, including a number of prominent computer people. Bill Joy, who was the chief scientist at Sun Systems for quite a few years, is a very strong critic. And Jaron Lanier, who is an early virtual reality experimenter and also a musician and thinker of other sorts, is a very strong critic as well. So since I haven't had a chance to talk to him in person, I can't really say. But I do know that, as I said, the antidote to me, what brought me back to Earth, was reading what was probably the Etiquette of Freedom, or one of the essays in The Practice in the Wild, of the Wild, where you talk about the mind itself as being a wild ecosystem and not the tameable, technologically malleable thing that he seems to think it is.
Right, which is my understanding of mind, the human mind, but not just the human mind, but the quality of mind as expressed in various organisms and beings throughout the biological universe. Anybody who's working in the field will tell you, we don't know anything about animal intelligence. We finally realized that everything we've been saying about animal intelligence so far has been modeled on assumptions about human intelligence. And we don't even know anything about human intelligence, in fact. This is such a wonderfully open territory that is expresses itself in so many different ways and is intrinsically very, very ancient. And at some point, you have to give up and confess that you don't know where it goes or what its source is. So first of all, I'm always suspicious of people who think they have lots of answers. I would be very suspicious right away of anybody who wanted to live forever, which is desperately unspiritual and flies in the face of the actual nature of physical existence on this planet, which is to accept change. Without impermanence, without change, we would truly be slaves. We would have no freedom. Freedom is only possible with death and fluidity. And one thing we don't even know is, what's death? And there's a Zen koan about, after the light falls from your eyes and the sound leaves your ears and your mind closes down, where do you go? They actually work on that. And the answers are, as best I can say, remarkably simple.
And are?
Oh, I'm not going to say.
Oh, okay.
It's too simple.
Okay. Now, I know that the idea, the perspective you come from is largely a Buddhist, ecological, Native American, shamanistic, I don't know what else you want to
biological.
Call it. Biological. Biological one.
You know, my own weird way of understanding biology, ecological sciences, and constructing, you know, what I think can be known about the biological, physical universe, nature, which is the whole phenomenal realm, as best I can. But I, you know, wouldn't try to argue that these are the only possible answers. And just the other day, I was up in northeastern Oregon at a literary conference called Fish Trap on the stage for a while, and somebody asked me, well, what does the future hold and where are we going? And my immediate response was, why is it that poets always have to be asked to be prophets? And secondly, you know, I've long ago learned, you know, to think about the future in terms of, at the very least, half a dozen scenarios that might be possible, not just one story. So your man, what's his name, Roy?
Ray Kurzweil.
Ray. Ray's got one story. That he's really locked into, apparently. And I hear it as interesting science fiction, which it probably is, that doesn't take into account, first, the organic complexity and antiquity of human intelligence and what we call the mind itself. That I would argue far outruns anything that could be done with computers. And secondly, that quality, that human capacity that is declared, for example, in the Abrahamic religions as to be one of the most defining characteristics of humanity, namely language, is not particularly civilized, is not particularly new, cannot be understood by logic or the rational mind, and has the qualities of a wild ecosystem. We are doing things all the time with our own mother tongue, natural language, that we have no idea of how we do it. And that's a good thing that we don't know, because we wouldn't be able to do it if we had to stop and think about it.
You say you don't like to predict the future. You don't like to be asked about the future. I'm going to, during the course of this program, bring back a couple of quotes that have struck me over the years. And I remember about 30 years ago, you said that sometimes when you spoke with students, they asked you what worried you about the future. And I think you said at that time it was the depletion of the gene pool, and that you were pleased to see that they understood exactly what you meant.
Yeah.
I think that whole question of the if you want to call it that, or the lack of or loss of biodiversity is a much greater problem now than it was 30 years ago. You might not want to predict the future, but are there things that worry you about it?
Well, I think we're going to hell in a handbasket from the looks of things.
Yep.
Biodiversity is going to take a serious hit. However, I was reading Tim Flannery's book, The Eternal Frontier, a couple of years ago, which is a useful corrective, because he reminds us of four or five major extinctions that took place over the last multi-hundreds of millions of years here. And what's interesting is how well, how remarkably the natural ecosystems responded and restored themselves and came up with a whole bunch of new critters. And so in that sense, it may be that whatever it is that's at work in ecosystem, cellular, energy and life has its own strategies that reach a lot farther than we can guess.
Yeah, I'm not particularly worried about us doing in the planet as a system or a being or whatever you want to call it. I'm more worried about our doing in ourselves, which we seem to be
pretty well at, especially spiritually. That is to say, it's a little sort of local village challenge for human beings, not to wreck the planet. And, you know, that would be a real loss of face.
Speaking of local villages and planets, you've lived in this area for 40 years now, little over 40 years.
Yeah.
That's about almost half your life. No, more than half your life.
Exactly half your life. Yeah.
You were born in California, in San Francisco, but you grew up in the Pacific Northwest. What brought you specifically to this area?
Chance, like everybody else practically. I was still an infant when they moved me from San Francisco back up to where my parents had lived most of their lives, both of my parents, the Puget Sound region. And that was my first landscape and my first array of smells and plants and animals, which was becomes deeply embedded in you. You never forget some of those first smells and memories. But I also was aware that we had roots and dimensions that went, you know, south into California and north into the Northwest, into Alaska. As a mountaineer, as a nascent mountaineer in my teens, and then a converted environmentalist in my late teens, and a long-distance backpacker and Forest Service laborer, I found myself living and working in a lot of different places up and down the coast. And realized that, you know, you can live in a lot of different places. So this place right here, the 2,000 to 4,000 foot level of the northern Sierra Nevada on the west side, is in the same gardening zone as the Rogue River Valley in the Sunset Garden Book. Much of southern Oregon and northern California blend together. And many of the trees and plants here are very, very familiar to me. A few are missing, like salmonberry. You have to go way up to Puget Sound before you see salmonberry. But it wasn't a big deal, you know, to be able to live here extend my consciousness to include even the Great Central Valley.
One of my favorite social analysts, I guess you'd say, is a fellow journalist named Joel Garreau. And he actually wrote a book about Ray Kurzweil and the whole idea of singularity called, I think, Conscious or Deliberate Evolution. I can't quite remember. But my favorite of his books is one he wrote, 30 years ago, called The Nine Nations of North America.
Yeah.
And basically all the places you have lived from north to south are in what he would call Ecotopia, taking the name from Ernest Kallenbach's novel, but imagining that it really is a literal one of the nations of North America, that there is a union of, to some degree, of climate, although some of it's cold and wet and some of it's very warm, but mostly of maybe consciousness or lifestyle. And you seem to feel at home from top to bottom of Ecotopia.
I wouldn't call it Ecotopia, but Ernie Kallenbach's novel was, you know, okay in its time. But there is actually some kind of a historical similarity in the Euro-American culture that moved in here, starting in the mid-19th century, that places it where it still is on the map, on the political map, as being largely voting Democratic and having one of the lowest ratios of church-going people in the whole nation, is along the Pacific Strip, which is to say the west of the mountain ranges. And from British Columbia, home of many little anarchist experiments, all the way down to the Tehachapi Range. But across the Tehachapis and into the Los Angeles Basin, you're into another culture, which belongs with the Southwest and the Midwest.
Right. Well, Garreau, in his book, he one of the nations of North America is Mex-America, and the capital of Mex-America is not Mexico City, but Los Angeles.
Who knows? You know, they say that Los Angeles is the capital of the third world right now. However, there is, you know, a cultural and political unity of a degree of sort that extends from halfway up at least California into British Columbia, into Canada, and into Southeast Alaska. However, that's just the recent arrivals, the Euro-Americans. And there are some actually quite noticeable differences between what the ecology and climate of homeland California is, core California, which is the valley and the coast range, which is that it's a Mediterranean climate and it doesn't have rain in the summer. A lot of people that move out here from other parts of the country it takes them a long time to realize that, if they ever do. But there is a line between the Pacific Northwest and California, and the line is between like doing cedar woodwork as the Northwest Coast Indians did, and doing basketry as the California Indians did. You know, finding a different creative outlet for your artistic impulses.
Although one of the startling features all up and down the coast is that compared to everything east of the Sierras, the Western Indians have been comparatively much more at peace with one another.
Maybe, maybe not.
No. Maybe they're just far enough apart.
Well,
and they don't have horses.
They were getting horses, yeah. When Chief Joseph made a run for Oregon with his whole tribe, they were on horseback. But, you know, slavery was a very common feature of the Pacific Northwest.
I didn't, actually.
You didn't know that?
No.
Well, Puget Sound, the Salishan people of the Puget Sound area, down to the bottom of Puget Sound is where sort of classical Northwest culture reaches. All the way up to Sitka, Alaska, and beyond is like one cultural zone. And the big tough guys were the Tlingits and the Haida. The Haida up in the Queen Charlotte Islands and the Tlingits up on in the Straits of Georgia and on Vancouver Island. They made raiding trips down into Puget Sound and took hundreds of people back to be working slaves. There's a whole lore of slavery in the Pacific Northwest. And the people of the Upper Columbia, around the Celilo Falls, around the Dalles, what's now the Dalles, they made slave raiding trips down to Northern California and picked up Modoc people and took them back up north, made them work.
Hmm.
human history is not always so benign.
I just visited the Columbia Basin for the first time about 2 years ago,
and is that right?
I'm just getting to know very little bit about it. But to go back briefly, and we're going to take a break in a few minutes, to living in Nevada County. When you moved here, you deliberately lived off the grid.
I had no choice. Deliberately, no. I would have taken electricity if it was available.
Mm-hmm. But another thing you said, maybe 30 years ago, was that your lifestyle was a combination of 19th and 21st century.
Well, that's what it came out to be, finally. And not just me, a lot of my neighbors. The 19th century side of it is wood-burning iron stoves, wood-fired saunas, and for a long time, kerosene lamps. 17 years on kerosene lamps. But we jump into the 21st century when we started putting up solar panels. And I have that combination now, a pretty good solar array, pretty much state-of-the-art batteries for a solar array now, and boy, they cost. A very good generator, finally, and which is, I don't know what technology that is.
I'd say early 20th century.
Early 20th century, yeah. And I still fire up my wood-burning cook stove in the winter to keep the house warm. I still heat the house with wood. But I appreciate the electric lights to read by using low draw curly Q compact fluorescence nowadays, and being very, very conscious of all of the the draw that I get from everything. And so, like, now, you know, my stepdaughter, who's taking courses up at on the top of the hill up there, or the Sierra Junior, or whatever they call it, the community college, she wrote a paper about my experience of alternative energy, saying she grew up with it and she didn't even know that it was green.
Why did you choose that? You said it was just chance that you came to this area, but within this area, how come you settled on the ridge rather than say?
Well, it just happened that friends of mine brought me up here because they said, there's a parcel up here that we looked at that another guy was going to buy it, but now he's not. And maybe two or three of us could go in and purchase it. And we found it, and it was out over a long dirt road that was barely in, with lots of ruts. And I walked the lines, I walked some lines with a compass, and I found a brass cap. And I looked around at the madrone, the Doug fir, the ponderosa pine, the mix of manzanita and a few other things. And I said, yeah, I could live here. So, you know, we decided to go ahead and buy it.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be here till 2 p.m. This is my last Booktown program on KVMR, and to come full circle with the first program I did 10 years ago, I'm talking with Gary Snyder about all sorts of things, but especially his life in Nevada County. We'll be back in a short time for more of this. And this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be with you for about another 20 minutes. This is my last Booktown. I've been doing it for 10 years, and to provide a little bit of symmetry, I've decided to come full circle and go back to people and topics from my first program 10 years ago, and that has led me to invite Gary Snyder, probably our most prominent local writer, but a person who I think of as much as a thinker and a guide as a writer. He's lived here for, I guess, exactly half of your life. Mm-hmm. And he said, well, we were off the air, that he would like to talk a little bit about some of the changes he's seen in the last 42 years.
In Nevada County.
Yeah.
On the west side. Yeah. I say on the west side because it's hard to get over and make sure what's going on the other side, over Donner Pass and down to Truckee.
Although you've spent so much of your life right on the top and down both sides.
Right along the ridge, but then when you get right along the ridge, the Pacific Crest, you know, when you get along the ridge, you don't look either direction. You stay up there. Mm-hmm. And you have to go farther south to get really high.
That's true.
Yeah, but it's nice, you know. It's really nice up there, and we are very fortunate here to be within an hour and a half range of a mini alpine zone, which is the Five Lakes Basin, Black Butte, the Grouse Ridge Lookout Area, and the Forest Service has phased out off-road vehicles and is making it into what will eventually be a nifty little semi-wild alpine ground to go up and camp and hike around in, with lots of little lakes and lots of great white granite boulders.
It's interesting because I think the last time I camped there was probably 20 years ago when we were all in cars.
Well, you can drive all the way to the Grouse Ridge Lookout parking lot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, everybody parks somewhere in there. Then you're on trail after that, and there's some great trails up there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're very fortunate to have that. And more people are using it, too. So that's just one of the many things that's happening.
And I'm one of those people who rarely goes far afield to whatever you want to call it, hike or walk. I will probably never use up all the walks around Nevada City.
Like Thoreau, right, yeah. Thoreau said you don't need a whole lot of space to walk in. You can spend your whole life within a 30-mile diameter. And, you know, his point is well taken. Well, you know, the population of Nevada County has, I don't know what it is. You know, it was 50,000 when I moved here. It was 25,000 when I moved here.
Now I'd say it's about 25, yeah.
Yeah, it's about 100,000 and some now.
Mm-hmm.
But that's par for the world, in a way. So it shouldn't surprise us. It doesn't surprise me anymore, actually. And when I go back to visit Japan, it has changed every bit as much and every bit as drastically.
With the population dropping.
It's not really.
Oh, okay.
They just say that. So we'll feel sorry for them or something. No, they're getting an aged population. That's their problem. They have a huge number of people in their late 80s and in their 90s now. And they have never confronted how you deal with aged people before in this situation, because historically, traditionally, families always took care of their own elders, and their own elders died at a reasonable age. And so, you know, centuries of family care on the one side for the older, as well as on the other side for the infants and the children, worked out just fine. But now the elders outnumber, you know, the younger people almost. And my son Kai was just over there for 2 weeks, and this is one of the reports he gave me, was what they're trying to do to keep the elders busy and happy, making them into docents and volunteers for everything.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very civilized country.
Right.
Yeah.
But I hear that everyone is this countryside is being deserted.
Well, that's because there's so much more money to be made in the city. And that's also a worldwide phenomenon,
mm-hmm.
flocking to the urban centers. Thanks to all this technology. And the only back ripple, interestingly, is these very highly educated, sophisticated young people going back to grow organic vegetables on country farms, which has, you know, taken off a bit. As Wendell Berry would say, one of the things that we need to rationalize our society and our economy is to charge more for food. We have the cheapest ratio of the cost of food to other things in the world. Government, you know, giveaways actually to agribusiness,
mm-hmm.
but better prices for food will pay for better growing, better gardening, and will make the ecological practices of agriculture better. And it's coming.
Especially since the subsidies all go for harmful practices or crops.
Well,
maybe not all, but a very large number.
I was at UC Davis on the faculty there for 16 years. I had friends who were in the agriculture side of it, and I had a few conversations with the chancellor. And the story is, you know, the university that sort of invented agribusiness, the factory farm, is now like a giant tanker slowly changing its course. Mm-hmm. And one of the reasons they're changing their course is the complaints that come in from the actual growers, the big growers, anybody who lives on the ground and is not an absentee owner, is noticing the higher rate of cancer in their own families. And it's a demonstrable truth now that something about pesticides and herbicides as have been used now for 80 years or more in the Great Central Valley in agriculture, are not affecting just the hired workers anymore. They're affecting the master's house, you know, so to speak. And that has, you know, triggered a lot of interest in shifting away from so much chemical use, as well as the fact that beyond a certain point, adding on more pesticides, more herbicides, and more fertilizer begins to lose money. It's got an optimum level of use that they have now exceeded, and the results aren't worth it anymore.
Does any of the change in Davis come from the student body? Because
the student body was well in advance.
Exactly.
They were 30 years in advance. But, you know, you have to be ready for that, you know. Like poets, they might be 200 years in advance.
And maybe that's why people ask you to predict the future.
Maybe, but I don't want to do it. Well, that certainly is true of William Blake. Nobody even knew who he was for 100 years. You know, and then they begin to notice him.
So in Nevada County, you've always, one of the, I'd say your salient features as a resident of this area has not just been that you sit on your land and write, but you've been very active in local affairs, especially on the ridge, but around the county as a whole.
Well, you know, there's a community life and a degree of citizenship that you just don't want to avoid. And you may be not able to take care of the whole world, but you at least ought to pay attention to your own backyard. But in any case, you know, I've always been politically and ecologically an activist of sorts. And it was only natural for me and for many of my neighbors to take it as part of the challenge and part of our responsibility to try to put our minds to work and our practices to work on what was happening here and in the county. And we've gone through a number of issues over the years, starting way back in the 70s with the whole idea of the building code and the owner-built home, and making it possible to legally build a house without electrical wiring,
mm-hmm.
Which is, you know, it's a moot point now.
I think you're also perhaps the single person most responsible for getting the concept of a watershed into the public mind. I mean, it's been an ecological term for decades, but people have only in the last 30 or 40 years really begun to understand how the importance of living in a particular bioregion or particularly around here in a watershed.
This is bringing, in a different way entirely from Ray, what's his name's?
Yeah, Kurzweil.
This is bringing science to bear on our social and cultural life, our day-to-day social and cultural life, which is to say that there have been for a long time professionals, specialists, land managers, etc., who used the terms of watershed and ecosystem and were aware of, you know, and had produced the maps that showed where was the rainfall, where were the soil types, and so forth. But that remained for a long time the domain of specialists, and particularly in the land grant universities,
mm-hmm.
and in some of the government agencies. And we have some of us, and interestingly enough, artists and, you know, dancers and musicians have been bringing those concepts across to the larger public, saying, hey, this is the way our world actually is. Let's see what we can learn from that. And so I propose that we will eventually, I mean, this is surely true, redraw the lines of the counties. And that the west side of Placer, Nevada County, and Yuba County will be one county. The east side of those three counties will have its capital, its county seat over in Truckee or someplace. And you won't have to go over the pass to go to a county meeting.
Right. Yeah. I remember about 30 years ago, I think he was our congressman then, a person that neither you or I had much otherwise in common with, Gene Chappie, was very pushing this idea, but it got nowhere.
Well, you know, when the time is right, when the time is right.
I think of, we were just talking about this, these ecological ideas spreading, and that made me think of another Ray Dassman, my late father-in-law, who was, I guess, the person who really popularized the idea of bioregions among ecologists. He made it a sort of standard idea academically. But again, as I was saying, you're one of the people who brought it to a wider consciousness. Is that consciousness going forward, do you think?
Surprisingly so. So much so, you know, I could, you know, if I had the list handy, I could read the latest textbook and semi-textbook and popular science booklets and essays that are beginning to come out. Or the references that are now through a lot of the environmental magazines that take the idea of the watershed as one of the natural nations that we can easily pay attention and overlapping that on the theoretical possible ecosystems, and then the term bioregion, which can be applied to a somewhat larger region. And that helps understand how nature is at work, but also how our economies fit into it and what is and is not possible or desirable within all of that. And so, you know, that leads us to rethinking, for example, California water. Big issue. Big issue.
Yeah, I know the Apple Center, a couple of blocks from here, the Apple Sustainability Center had a exhibit 3 months ago, I think, on water issues, and they said that the amount of water that is allocated through various agreements is 8 times the amount annually available. This is the sort of thing that's going to hit us really hard in a few years.
Well, you remember a couple of years ago, Schwarzenegger was saying California is having a drought. That was pure political fluff. We had had average, normal Sierra Nevada snowfall and rainfall that summer. That winter, or we were just a little short on the snowfall. But it was, you know, we had hit our annual average rainfall here in the county and gone over it a bit. And so, you know, the point is, and one of the people in government also said this, we don't have a drought, we just have too much need for water. You know, nature is providing as much water as it ever provided, you know, within that fluctuating scale. Nature is not at fault. It's us that have to rethink our priorities, and also, you know, how many of us there are.
And that leads us right back again to this area. In all of the dire forecasts I can imagine of global warming or possible earthquakes or running out of water, we seem to be situated in one of the lucky spots.
Yeah, well, this is a relatively lucky place to be, in fact, with a moderate climate. You can still just about count on getting water if you drill a well, you know, a few things like that.
And if you don't, there's enough of it flowing over the surface that it'll get to you eventually.
Well, not
for everyone.
Not for everyone, no. I should mention, incidentally, a book that's just out in the bookstores now, which is called The Great Bay, written by a Nevada County resident, Dale Pendell. An old friend of mine, and it is a, we could call it science fiction, speculation, very, very astutely drawn, projecting one or two stories of what can happen here in Western North America over the next 6,000 years.
Right.
Charming book.
Yeah, I interviewed him about a month ago.
You did, huh?
And he was one of the people I was glad to have on in my last 3 weeks. We only have a little bit of time left. You talked, when we've talked before, about things we might talk about on this program. One of the things that you brought up several times was China, and we've barely talked about that you've spent, I think, eight or nine of your years living in Japan, and you've been back to the Orient many times.
Yeah.
But you seem to be, right now, drawn perhaps more to China than to Japan?
East Asia.
Mm-hmm.
I really try to think in terms of East Asia, which is China, Korea, Japan, Taiwan, and Vietnam. I know Japan pretty well. I lived there, actually. I had my house there for 12 years. I've only traveled a little bit in China because it was closed for so many years. I've had some good visits to Taiwan and a brief visit to Vietnam back in 1962. Anyway, China is a puzzle. It has some of the most elegant philosophical and social thinking of any society I know. I'm a great fan of the Analects of Confucius and a number of other writings of early science and what you might call spiritual and psychological writings as well. As well as the marvelous poetry and the marvelous graphic art that Chinese culture has produced over the centuries. But I'm becoming more and more aware that there is no one monolithic China, and that that is its own myth that it has promulgated pretty successfully to the world. China is a diverse nation of many different, mutually unintelligible, though related, languages, and people who aren't always on great terms with each other, and with very different ecosystems between the North and the South, between the West and the East. And they are now, you know, brought up against acknowledging what they really are, and what, you know, and looking at their own limits, and just barely beginning to realize that they have some limits.
I would say they're a mountainous bulb at the end of the continent, just as Europe is, and they had the good fortune to have a language, a writing system that unified the languages, which Europe never did. Otherwise, they have many similarities in their diversity and and in the difficulty they sometimes have keeping together.
Well, I sometimes wonder if the Chinese writing system really has done them a good service. You know, the other side of it. Europe, for a number of centuries, managed to keep up a certain unity between the evolving countries after the Roman Empire fell, with the use of Latin. Latin was the lingua franca. The French, the French was Latin, through you know the Middle Ages and the Renaissance, and that served the same function as Chinese characters serve for bridging the gap from bridging it from language to language. But I don't know if that serves them well anymore because it is something of an illusion, and they're forced to the point where they have to look at the diversity of ecosystems and peoples if they're going to manage into the future.
And what strikes me the most is that they have to look at the diversity of policies. And in some ways, Chinese policy, say specifically on ecological issues, is way, way, way in advance of American, at least in what they say and what they acknowledge. But then when you turn around and look at what they do, they're as bad or worse.
Well, you know, there are people who believe that writing makes it true, which is not true. You know, the West has got that problem, too. And then one always thinks back to the Constitution of the Soviet Union, written in the 30s, which was the most idealistic constitution you can imagine and was never put into practice.
Mm-hmm. We've got about a minute to go.
Well, Eric, it has been great to have you on the radio. And I have tuned in and listened from time to time over the years. And I know that I'm going to go on knowing you and seeing you, so I'm not so worried, but I'm not sure all your audience understands that.
Well, this program, this is the last of the regular on-air programs, but I am going to continue to occasionally blog about books I've read, and I think I will conduct interviews occasionally, and they will be online.
That's nice.
And I may even be able to podcast them through KVMR, but there won't be anything on this time of every other Monday. Who knows? There may be another book program.
Somebody else may come into the technological era of smartphones.
Could be. I don't have a cell phone yet, and it's going to be probably several years before I do. There's certain technologies I'm very happy to jump on top of as soon as they come out, and certain of them I'm quite happy to let go on their own for who knows when I'll pick them up. Anyway, this is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I've been talking with Gary Snyder, and now we're making way for Jimmy Carty's Rock and Roll Party. Mm-hmm.